This Bokomi cast features two of the marketing industry's most wanted minds, Unilever Chief Executive Alan Jope and Publicis Sapient Chief Executive Nigel Vars.
Just out of curiosity, Richard, I didn't look this up, but what does OMI and Bokomi mean?
It stands for Original Memorable Insights.
Okay, got it. So it's an acronym. It's not like some Japanese haiku.
No, and it doesn't mean I'm wearing wet trousers or anything like that.
Hello there, I'm Rich Kilgariff. Welcome to the Bokomi cast. Every week I ask someone at the top of their industry to pick a title from our most wanted list of new nonfiction at Bokomi.com. This week it's Alan Jope, the chief executive of Unilever PLC, the global company behind household names like Magnum, Lynx, Dove, Bovril, Persil and Ben & Jerry's ice cream. Alan has picked digital business transformation, how established companies sustain competitive advantage from now to next, by Nigel Vars. Here's why.
Hello, Bokomi. Alan Jope here. Well, I want Nigel Vars's book on my bookshelf because he offers a comprehensive and insightful overview of the apparently boundless space of digital business transformation. With his unique knowledge of the practitioner and his gift for the anecdote, he's written a compelling account of why digital business transformation is so much bigger than just the technology alone.
Thank you, Alan Jope. And then I interview the author so that you, by the power of audio technology and the human brain, can generate original, memorable insights of your own.
Hey everyone, I'm Nigel Vars, CEO of Publicis Sapient and author of Digital Business Transformation, and this is my OMI for Bokomi.
Nigel's book has got original, memorable insights for anyone leading or in a company through one of the most disruptive moments, if not the most disruptive moment, of the modern industrial age. Nigel Vars, welcome to the Bokomi cast.
It's great to be on, Richard.
In the book, you say books are read by individuals. Digital business transformation is brought about by teams. Why not just record a presentation that can be viewed by lots of people at once? Why write a book about this subject?
Well, I got to start off by saying I'm a little biased here personally because I'm a huge fan of books and I'm always, I have several on the go at once and I consume them using different media technology. Sometimes I'll listen to them, I'll read them in print, I'll read them digitally on my iPhone or my iPad. And yes, I do read books on my phone a lot because I'm standing in line in immigration and lots of places with lots of time to kind of kill at times. And it depends really on what mode I'm in. But for me, the distinction I make in the book is not really about the way you frame the question. It's not about how a book or ideas are delivered. It's about how these ideas are going to turn into action. And for me, in that comment that I make in the book, I go on to say that the real or enduring change is never the legacy of a single person. That success belongs to groups and is rarely the result of any individual endeavor. And in the context of transforming a business, in my experience of over 25 years and the 30 years that Publicis Sapient's been working with so many of these established businesses that you called out, you know, the biggest achievements within those organizations always come about as a result of exceptional teamwork. And so when you think about the digital transformation that any business, you know, is kind of undergoing, the real value in that is being clear, having a shared understanding of what you want to be in this world and a collective commitment to change. And I quote Margaret Mead in the book, you know, who was one of my favorite quotes is, you know, never doubt that a small, thoughtful group of committed citizens can change a world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has. And so for me, the book, you know, couldn't effectively be converted into a presentation because it's not about telling a large audience what to do. There's no one-size-fits-all digital business transformation blueprint. In simple terms, digital business transformation is nothing but business transformation for a world that is increasingly digital. And when you have so many different companies operating in so many different industries that will face each of these ideas that I'm talking about differently, given their own unique context, the only two things they can have in common is the need to create an organization that can continually change at pace with the changes around them and make sure that they are able to identify and realize value both for their customers and themselves. And after that, it's all about how you actually, in the context of your organization with the people around you, bring that to life.
We've jumped ahead a little bit, haven't we? Because the quote I just read out then was towards the end of the book. You begin the book and you frame the book with some very strong metaphors, the strongest of which I think is the idea of a digital moat around a fortress, building on Warren Buffett's idea and metaphor of an economic moat. What is a digital moat, and why do businesses need one that is deep, wide, and complete?
Well, when you think about what Warren Buffett was trying to talk about at the time to his shareholders and to the world at large, was talking about how, you know, the traditional successful organization's competitive advantage in terms of its core products, services, brands, economies of scale, and efficiencies were all sources of competitive advantage that made it very hard for some new entrant to overcome those. Now, the challenge currently is the traditional sources of value that determine the width of that moat are no longer sufficient to sustain competitive advantage, and you only have to look at the most valued companies in terms of market cap or growth rate to validate that, right? There's lots of companies that are coming in disrupting effectively the status quo. And when you look at who these companies are that are coming in, the most foundational component there is them reimagining how the business model of the industry that they're trying to disrupt operates. And there's plenty of examples, you know, we can all kind of cite around us. But when you look under the covers of what is actually the foundational component of building that moat, it's really about that organization's ability to kind of learn, unlearn, and relearn. And a simple example of this is kind of Netflix. You know, when Netflix came on the scene, I'm sure there were lots of blockbuster executives at the time high-fiving themselves on having disrupted every single mom-and-pop video store in most of the Western world, right? Blockbuster had, as a chain, had dominated that space and replaced video rental stores that were very local before the entrance of something like Blockbuster and completely taken it over. But Netflix came in and said, well, what if we disrupt just the last mile of that problem and send that mail order DVD to your house and have you mail it back? Now, many people forget that that was the origin of Netflix, right? It was a DVD mailing company. Its expertise relied fundamentally in posting you DVDs and having you post them back so you didn't have to walk the few blocks that you needed to get to the Blockbuster. But then Netflix very quickly, I think as an organization, understood that if it stayed there, it would get disrupted itself. And this is one of the kind of key principles of this idea of a digital moat. So what it did is it actually then moved into saying, well, how do we disrupt ourselves? Well, what if you didn't have to walk anywhere to post anything or receive anything, and we could just stream video content to your homes? And they invested in changing the technology, the people, the infrastructure to go make that happen. And then they disrupted themselves again because they started to realize that just streaming other people's content would potentially leave them open to again being disrupted. And now they're the largest content provider, you know, in terms of content creators in the world, or one of the largest, from ostensibly being a mail order DVD business. And when you think about that idea of that kind of, you know, digital moat that they were creating, is they were basically continually reinventing themselves, learning, unlearning, and relearning what it took to be successful in their business, and then making the moat wider and deeper by ensuring the sum of capabilities that they put in place around their streaming infrastructure, around the data around what people were watching, to then start to become sources of competitive advantage that now make it harder if you or I were to decide to go start a streaming business, you'd be coming up against the huge wall of data that Netflix has in terms of what people are watching and how they're watching it, and using that data and other insights to come up with new sources of programming. So a digital moat is essentially the sum of capabilities that you put in place to create value and be competitive in a digital world. If you prefer the kind of instruction for how to build a company that can drive business outcomes through its ability to evolve products, services, experiences that are continually aligning itself with customer behavior and technology.
You highlight four aspects of a rapidly changing world: customers, technology, society, and business models. Which is the most pressing for you personally, and why?
You know, I guess I talk about these as the four forces of connective change, right? And the fact that they are connected means the answer to that question really is kind of none of them and all of them. You know, if you look at the nature of these four forces, what you start to see is every one of these forces is undergoing radical change themselves, but combined, they're fundamentally changing our experience as people and as human beings more broadly, right? And when you start to think about the impact of any business in terms of its core strengths and areas where it's weak and susceptible to market forces, you start to see these changes at play. So let's just take an example. You know, I'm a huge fan of London taxis. And you know, whenever people ask me what one of the favorite things I liked about London were, I would always cite the black cabs, the knowledge of the drivers, the shape of the car, and how easy it is to kind of travel in one of them, right? But at the time, you know, I would still be facing all of the usual challenges you faced with cabs, which is London, it tends to rain a lot, and you're sitting in, you know, in the office, and you kind of can't leave because you know you're going to go outside and you're not going to find a cab to your next destination because it's raining, and usually that's when they're in short supply. So then, all of a sudden, enter Uber. Now, you could argue that Uber is a technological change, of course, because the fundamental premise of Uber was allowing you as a customer to be geolocated and connected to a car that could get you from point A to point B. So of course, you know, it was a technological change. But it was also a change in fulfilling consumer expectations or consumer behavior that said, or a consumer need that said, I need to get from point A to point B. And the mismatch between supply of cabs and the demand of people, especially in times of inclement weather or late at night or unpopular destinations, made it very hard to get one. So all of a sudden, you know, you start to see, okay, there's a technological shift, there's a consumer shift. And then you start to say, well, how does Uber actually monetize this? You know, how does it actually create benefit for itself? And how does it create benefit for, you know, the drivers, people who are now being brought into employment, or potentially for the customer who are perhaps able to pay less than they would a black cab? And all of these things, and of course, the societal implications of both the problem of, you know, bringing people who wanted to work part-time into the workforce, which Uber does really well, and the challenge of perhaps now the quote-unquote, you know, challenges faced by gig workers who want to be treated like regular workers. And, you know, you can start to see the kind of dichotomy of all of these changes. And when you look at all of this, you know, from my perspective, I call this ecosystem evolution, right? So is Uber just a digital, you know, kind of logistics and transportation business, or is it a platform business model that grows in value with every new driver and every new rider? You know, has growth come with certain expectations about how it therefore ought to contribute? And, you know, we've seen, for example, the fact that they're now providing drivers healthcare and they're providing them sick leave, which, you know, which is a big step from perhaps the way the model had originally been envisaged, right? So when you think about customer behavior, I guess the key point, if I had to pick each one of these forces, the balance of power has definitely moved from companies to customers. There is absolutely no question about that, right? Whose expectations are set by anybody and everybody that they work with, which means an Uber could well be setting expectations for how you bank with your bank, or Netflix could well be setting expectations for how you get healthcare provided to you. And all of those are changing at an extraordinary rapid pace, right? Because the best experiences that consumers have define the experiences they want across every other sector. Technological change, you know, ultimately technology is the enabler that allows business to identify and unlock customer value. That's kind of clear. But it's not only the technological change over time at the individual level, but the technology change in the center of organizations, and together the power of technology in the hands of the individual, the power of technology in the context of being central to an organization's success, puts it in a really wonderful, you know, connected ecosystem that allows you to do very different things. Business models, are obviously following the technology and the consumer. So every time you start to see these two consumer and technological trends shift, you're also starting to see huge amounts of business model shift and funding models that continue to now allow these new businesses to develop. And finally, I think societal change. In the past, I feel like companies operated with a sense that I'm the provider of the product and service and my customers are what I care about. And today, that's not enough. Customers look at what we do as an organization more broadly, as well as how we do it, not only in relation to what they touch directly, but across the entire supply chain. And you know, Unilever and Alan Jope are probably one of the best examples of this as an organization, right? Because they've always been pioneers of driving sustainable change in business, because they understood, you know, fundamentally, it doesn't only matter what you say, but what you are and what you do. And that's what customers are judging you on today.
And the thrust of the book seems to be not highlighting that change is anything new. Change has always happened. And you talk about companies moving from one distribution platform to another. I mean, Vivendi did it with TV from being a utility. It's always been the case that data and set-top boxes and any connection into the home is going to be valuable. But it's the rate of change which is startling and that you highlight so eloquently in the book. Do you think the pandemic has, for the large companies that you deal with in particular, created either an opportunity or I would say probably an alarm call, really, to accelerate their change or move beyond what they're good at? You make that point in the book that, you know, companies have built up expertise in areas which might now seem redundant. Who are the winners and losers in the pandemic which forces and accelerates change that was happening rapidly and exponentially anyway?
You know, I think the thing you have to start, Richard, in the way that you are, you know, asked that, right? And just talk about us as people and think about how we actually, you know, deal with change generally as individual and as people, right? And fundamentally, we as people, you know, really are geared to deal with change at a pace that is linear, right? And what the pandemic, you know, showed is that when you actually continue to accelerate that change and that change starts to head towards the exponential, as people, as individuals, and therefore then collectively as organizations, we struggle. And what the pandemic, you know, highlighted for me, I mean, the world went into lockdown twice as I was writing the book, is this idea of whether or not you need to be a digital business may have been a question to some organizations, but the majority of organizations had already understood that. But what it did is it took it from understood and important, but potentially tangential to quote unquote what they saw as their core business, to existential. We cannot survive without this being something that is a core part of our DNA. So it absolutely shifted the dynamic. And of course, COVID was a very real human tragedy, right? So you don't ever want to make light of it. But in a business context, what it definitely demonstrated is very quickly, you as a business couldn't ignore it because your consumers couldn't ignore it, and you couldn't carry on with business as usual, literally or metaphorically. So if you didn't have a functioning digital channel, or at least a digital channel, if not the business itself was operating digitally, from how you actually, you know, thought about your supply chain and procured products, to how you actually thought about manufacturing, to how you thought about R&D, to how you thought about marketing, to how you thought about sales and transactions. Every single aspect of this needed to kind of be reimagined, right? And we saw businesses do that in some cases extraordinarily well, and in some cases, you know, ones that really struggled. So the winners and losers, again, going back to the conversation we had about the digital moat earlier, were organizations that could rely on the investments they'd already made getting into the pandemic, and then continue to accelerate that over the course of the pandemic to get themselves into a better situation. And, you know, if you look more broadly at industries generally, you could really start to see, you know, even the ones where people thought, well, these are, you know, quote unquote, industries that are entirely physical. They're based on, you know, how people interact physically, really reimagine how technology could actually help be disruptive, right? From the acceleration of remote healthcare being the most obvious example. What do you do when you're in the middle of a pandemic and you potentially are feeling ill, but the whole premise of a pandemic is you have to stay separated from potentially even the people that provide you healthcare. So to the extent that you could actually access healthcare digitally, you know, makes a huge difference. Or, you know, somebody asking a very obvious question, which is, well, why do I have to go into a bank to open a bank account when I don't have to go to an Apple store to open an iTunes account? So if my iTunes account can be functional from home, why can't my bank be? And I think these kinds of seminal questions separated the winners and the losers.
And a sense of scale really helps at this point, doesn't it, in terms of time, looking towards the past. We spend a lot of time imagining the future, but you point out in the book that we can learn from the past every day. And you talk about visiting the Museum of Natural History in New York, and how, looking at the exhibits there, it displays our extraordinary ability to adapt and change. But are we changing fast enough to keep pace with AI, with technology as humans? You talk about how we are as people. We haven't changed as people for 70 to 100,000 years in terms of our brains. Are we getting ahead of ourselves if we think that we can outrun the natural world with technological innovation, i.e. human beings being part of the natural world? Are we not quite capable of keeping up with Ray Kurzweil's vision of the singularity, or, you know, a world where everything is connected, everything is on, everything is automated?
Well, you know, Kurzweil's law of accelerating returns talks roughly about the fact that every decade or so, technological progress doubles, right? So the rate of acceleration is growing kind of exponentially. The natural history, the Museum of Natural History in New York is, you know, just a personal space that I absolutely love. And like you said, it really allows you to catalog, you know, us over, you know, hundreds of years and thousands of years, right? And the reason I actually talk about that as the backdrop was to illustrate exactly the point that we're talking about. When you think about, you know, it representing knowledge about life on Earth and how it's changed. And then, you know, to illustrate this point, because not only are we seeing the rate of change increase, but we're also seeing the scale of change increase. So to illustrate just this very simply, one of the things I did in the book is I illustrated this idea of exponential change, which is, you know, of course, something we all understand conceptually, right? But when you place yourself in this metaphorical situation that I'm describing in the book, it really just, you know, for me, I can see people recognize what this means in practical terms, right? So here in the museum's rotunda was a Borosaurus, which is one of the largest freestanding displays in the world. And so I did a calculation using that actual space to say, what would it take to fill the Natural History Museum's rotunda with water at a linear pace? And the answer, which I talk about in the book, is 752,589 years. So you just imagine, right? You know, most people couldn't fathom that length of time. And that's how long it would take, of course, if, you know, you filled it up one drop at a time. And then you start to say, well, okay, what happens if you actually change that to be exponential? You know, one drop, two drops, four drops. And all of a sudden, it goes from 752,589 years to 38 minutes. 38 minutes. And then the most poignant kind of, I guess, point is, you know, if you were observing this and you assume that current rate of change will extend into the future, you can kind of react to that, right? But just 5 minutes before that 38 minutes, just 5 minutes before that, right? the water was at the a sort of little puddle at the feet of the dinosaur in the museum. And 10 minutes later, it's a building filled with water. So you just kind of think about that. You know, 28 minutes, and it's a puddle, and it's an annoyance and a distraction, and this really large building 10 minutes later is entirely filled with water. And the point is, this exponential change means that most of us can't fathom what the future holds in the context of just the sheer sense of change. But what you can do is start to build the muscles in your organization to be able to continually evolve and change. You know, it's like that old Darwin quote of, you know, adaptability winning over scale and size. And, you know, if you were just to use another example here, right, to illustrate this point, you know, if you think about land-based transportation and how long people have been walking, right? We've been walking, you know, for 1.9 million years, right? Which is when Homo erectus formally, what Darwin actually is cataloged as walking. You know, 5,500 years ago, 1.9 million years ago, we start walking, and 5,500 years ago, we basically start to use animals, right? And then in 150 years ago, we start to use cars. And only, you know, in the last 18 years or so, you first saw Tesla come in, which basically made us think about the car more as a software product and an electronic product as opposed to the combustion engine, which was one of the biggest innovations of the 150 years of cars. And Uber, even later than that, effectively saying, well, what if you didn't own a car at all and you can get from point A to point B? So if you just look at some of these things, you start to see that exponential effect in so many places, right? I mean, just take the pandemic as an example. The earliest vaccine that was ever produced prior to the pandemic, the fastest, was 4 years. It took 4 years to produce the next fastest vaccine. But the pandemic forced us to re-examine every aspect of how we make a vaccine. And, you know, now thousands, if not millions of people all across the world are being vaccinated with vaccines that didn't exist a year ago, because a year ago we didn't know that the pandemic existed. And that's kind of, you know, another real life example playing out in front of our eyes of how we can imagine industries to fundamentally be reimagined.
The industries and the organizations that you talk about, wrapped around them at the moment, digital transformation is a force molding business, and it's not a place to be reached. You don't suddenly wake up one morning and say, I'm digitally transformed.
Absolutely.
So how does a company know it's getting it right? Because I'm old enough, as you are, I believe, to remember when head of digital or director of digital was like a new job. It was like a new, you know, it was kind of the newest job in the building. And now it's seems somewhat old-fashioned to actually even mention digital in the title of a role, don't you think? Is it still a function or a department? Shouldn't it be invisible now?
Well, it's a great question, you know, and I talk about the story in the book, but which I'll recount here, is when I started researching, you know, other changes in organizations over the period of history to start to contextualize what we're going through now, one of the things I came across was the original use of the title CEO. Many people might not know this, was for chief electricity officer. So these were people that existed in the early 19th century who were effectively helping people get to grips with electricity in the 20th century and kind of beyond, helping them, you know, try and figure out how their businesses would be changed with electricity. And now you can imagine that, right? Picture yourself in a factory in Victorian England, basically, you know, now starting to get to grips with, well, we make a lot of stuff by hand, and we are now accelerating making it by hand through electricity. And that, you know, that shift, right, is pretty significant because it was fundamental to a business. Yet, we don't see chief electricity officers exist today. And the reason we don't is, to your point, it's become ubiquitous, right? That said, every business relies on electricity as much as anything. And you know, we all do in our homes and in modern life. So when you start to think about, you know, the competitive advantage of digital companies in the context of, you know, the question you asked, right, is we're not, transformation isn't a destination, it's a journey. So the first idea you actually have to get to grips with is this idea that you need to develop muscles that allow you to continually change, continually ride the shifts of consumer behavior, of technological change, of new business models, and societal change in order to continually develop what's expected. So I developed a kind of framework to think about the capabilities that would allow you to do this in the organization, you know, as easily as you potentially could think about them. And if you think about most digital businesses, these are some things that are kind of inherent to them, but many established businesses don't always think about these capabilities in this way. And the acronym is pretty easy to remember. It's called SPEED. And SPEED literally and metaphorically meaning you move faster, but since it's an acronym, every letter stands for something. So the S in SPEED stands for strategy, for developing and testing your hypothesis on where value pools exist and how you can unlock them. So effectively being really clear, what is the strategic imperative for what change you are trying to drive in your organization? The P stands for product. And historically, businesses, especially in the digital age in the early days, thought about life, and still do, as projects. A project begins, a project ends, and then are we digitally transformed or not? And my belief is that you have to move the concept of from project to product. A product is not something that ever gets done. It's constantly evolving and constantly iterating and constantly allowing you to move at pace and scale by consistently moving it along the journey. The E is experience. So how you can enable amazing experiences and value for your customers in terms of what they can benefit from. So what is the value to the customer in the context of the experience? Not only in terms of the thing you're offering, but making the thing you're offering easy to use and consume. The next E is engineering. So how do you actually move the conversation about technology from being about risk and cost, which sat in the CFO bucket, you know, as keep the cost down, keep the risk low, to this idea of engineering, which where technology powers every aspect of your business and really allows you to move and deliver on those experiences you want to create at scale. And finally, data, which is all about validating the initial hypotheses you kind of set out in that strategic idea and uncovering insights that allow you to constantly iterate. So my belief is if you actually set out these speed capabilities and deliver those in an organization in an interconnected fashion, it's very, very different. You know, because I'll give you an example. While it's kind of pretty easy to talk about digital moats of digitally native companies, right? When you start to think about established organizations' orientation to how they create value, it's incredibly daunting. But a great example right in front of us right now, as I talked about Netflix earlier in the podcast, is think about Walt Disney. You know, Walt Disney's CEO, Bob Iger, had spoken about the importance and challenge of maintaining relevance pretty openly, and also about how you had to consider disrupting yourself. And as they were thinking about some of the foundational aspects of what made them successful, they realized that they had to do that for themselves, and they launched Disney Plus. And if you think about Disney's life pre-Disney Plus, right, they basically licensed and distributed their most core asset, their content, to anybody and everybody. But with the launch of Disney Plus, they disrupted that model pretty significantly. And in order to enable this, they reorganized their business and placed all of their direct-to-consumer platforms, technology, international operations under a kind of single leader to allow and support not only Disney Plus, but ESPN and Hulu and all of the other things they had, because they wanted to leverage the content, but also the technology and the data and the experience capabilities they had across the organization. And as they started to integrate these capabilities, they surfaced greater customer insights, which of course allowed them to think about more personalization and a better experience. So when Disney Plus was finally launched in 2019, Disney projected it would have between somewhere in the region of about 60 to 90 million subscribers by 2024. So the typical five-year plan. And, you know, yes, the pandemic certainly helped this acceleration, but by May of 2020, it had 54.5 million customers. And very recently, I want to say about a month ago, it reached 100 million customers in 16 months. And if you just think about that, you know, 100 million customers in 16 months, when Netflix, which has been the dominant player in the space, is at about 200 million customers. So when you actually now start to think about the imperative, you know, that they put themselves through pre-crisis, when the crisis came and it shut down revenues from its theme parks and its cruises, Disney was one of the few businesses that reported overall growth. A lot of it was, of course, attributed to this new Disney Plus model. And it launched something in a space that already had a pretty competitive landscape with people like Amazon and Netflix. But what was so powerful about this is it gave you an example of an existing business that essentially took on its competitors that were digitally native by leveraging its core assets and building these speed capabilities into themselves as a core part of how they did stuff. And so when you actually, you know, start to look at that, you really get a sense that this is the kind of shift we're talking about.
You say change can be difficult and it can hurt, but ultimately you see change as a good thing. How do you square this philosophy, this no pain, no gain philosophy, with the stated aim, the very clear aim of digital products and services to always make life easier for consumers and communities? Isn't there a strange paradox at work there, in that trying to make the world easier and more fluid, we don't have the grit left in us to deal with change and to be more resilient?
You know, it is a really fascinating question, right? And I think it's so individual and kind of so personal. You know, we're constantly having this conversation at home because my wife has a particular passion for interiors and thinking about how they could be organized differently. And I always, you know, I'm equally surprised and perturbed every time I come home and I find our living room has all been reconfigured. And it takes me, you know, some while to get my bearing to figure out what is where and is it good, is it bad? And I think if you just look at most people naturally in any context, change in and of itself is not something that we lean into as people, from the smallest changes to the biggest changes, right? And when I was sitting at the Olympics in London, which I was fortunate to be at, and I, you know, was watching this race that Mo Farah ran in, and I was sort of watching him run. And as you know, the races, both of them that he won, were long races. And so even for people who are passionate about athletics and sport, it was a long race. And sort of as we watched him running around and you sort of saw him on the screens, you sort of realized that what we were watching at the time, at least it occurred to me, was a lot of focus and intensity and pain, which if it was a sprint, you might have missed, you know. And Usain Bolt was one of the few that made it seem very easy. But with Mo, you know, he typified most of us. And at the end, when he wins, he does this, you know, famous Mo salute and a smile, and he's draped with a flag, and it's the picture that all of us remember and that's on the newspapers. But it occurred to me as sitting in the audience there, getting to that point, from getting in shape, from, you know, getting going to picking up pace from slow to fast, and then overcoming all of the things he would have had to overcome. And then even in the race, when he's finally there in that moment, he's going to take the majority of time with focus and intensity and pain, and maybe a couple minutes of celebration. And so for me, it just kind of created this idea that, you know, as you look at something in an organization that you kind of admire, you recognize that, you know, the bit that you see in the picture on the cover of the book is of an iceberg. Because the bit that you see in an organization, like, oh, now I can open a bank account from home. Oh, now I can actually, you know, use the list on my grocery app to navigate me around the physical supermarket to find all my products. And if I don't want to go in there the next time and just order from home, it remembers what I ordered, right? These things seem kind of rather small, and they're the bits that we see. But they take huge amounts of change in the way that these organizations actually operate under the surface. And that change is, of course, hardest on the people who have to go through that change. And so often, I think when you think about, you know, transformation, when you think about, you know, the bit that you see above the glass, the bit that you see kind of on your phone, is sort of like the tip of the iceberg. The bit that sits underneath that is often hidden. And, you know, you kind of recognize that that is actually the, you know, the bit that I equate to the celebration, you know, that one beautiful experience you have of saying, wow, this really surprised and delighted me how easy this was, how simple they made it. But the work that went into going, making it simple was pretty hard on not only the people in the organization and perhaps lots of partner organizations. All those things made it simple for me, the customer, then to use it. And coming right full circle back to, you know, my living room, I'm often then delighted by the fact that, wow, I didn't actually think that the view from here allowed me to see this, because this, you know, particular chair or couch is placed in a particular spot that I never really appreciated. And it was great. But of course, you know, the hard work wasn't done by me in order to experience that moment. And I feel like that is the relationship that we have today between people in organizations and customers.
Well, that puts things into perspective, because I think we all are experiencing different dynamics and microsystems through the last year. On a final note, looking towards the future of employment, Nigel, I mean, you work with so many different companies who each have their own different characteristics, and you say every organization is different, just like every family is different in its own way. The World Economic Forum estimates that 133 million new types of technology jobs will be created between 2018 and 2022, as you state in the book. How do you think this change, technological change, and combined with the double effect of the pandemic, has affected and will affect the type of jobs that we'll be doing nearer in the future now? We were talking beyond, you know, a few, you know, a decade or so or 5 years, but it's the future is right here, right now, isn't it? What should people be thinking about in terms of new jobs? Because everything you hear on the news at the moment is, oh, when will things go back to normal? When we go back to normal, this will happen. I don't think things will ever be like they were before. So what does the future look like in terms of the new jobs? What should young people coming through university now, what should they be preparing themselves for?
You know, I'll start this with a story. I have an 11-year-old son, and I'm constantly in conversation with him, because I tell him that, you know, the industrial age perpetuated this orientation that said you study for the first third of your life, you then work for the next third of your life, and depending how well you do the first two, you live, quote unquote, retire for the last third of your life, right? I mean, that was the model that was perpetuated. And my feeling is, for somebody like him who's 11 or somebody kind of entering the workforce, almost everything you're taught over the 4 years of your university degree is likely going to be obsolete by the time you actually reach the job that you're going to be in, the first job that you're going to be in. So then the question becomes, well, what is the value of the learning? And it's not to say that university degrees or learning in university is not important. But what is more important is that you learn to learn. Not that you focus on what you're learning, because your life is going to be a constant operation of learning, relearning, unlearning what you've learned in order to learn something new. And if you now apply this to, I sit on the World Economic Forum Digital Leadership Group, which is a digital body that they have. And we're constantly in conversations about the stats that you shared, you know, which is there's going to be like 133 million new technology roles that are going to be generated between, you know, 2018 and 2022. But then we also know that more than half of all employees will require significant reskilling and upskilling to do the jobs that they do today. And just the tech sector alone, forget about the fact that we're talking about the digital transformation of all business, you know, is short 4.3 million workers, right? And if you're an optimist, you say, well, that's an indicator of incredible growth and opportunity. And it is. But at the same time, it's also incredibly daunting because so many of these maturing organizations that are going through transformation need to start to think about talent. And it's a critical area, whether it's in areas of the speed capabilities that I talk about, you know, or newer areas that are constantly evolving that might, you know, if you're a grocery business, the impact of blockchain and you know, being able to track everything from farm to table for your customers, or if you're a bank providing wealth management advice, thinking about, you know, the role that AI could play in making your advisor smarter and kind of more relevant. When you start to think about all of these things, you really start to think about the fact that the recovery from not only the pandemic, but just the journey that we're about to begin over the next few years is going to need this idea of really making sure that we instill this notion that learning is not something you do in the first third of your life, but something that is an intrinsic part of every organization's expectations of their current workforce. And as you are coming into the workforce as a student, the most important thing for you to think about is how can I make sure that I'm constantly learning the ability to learn more than I am simply learning whatever I'm being taught right now, and working to identify the mismatch between, I think, and you know, education system to some extent, which was very geared towards learning things that didn't change. And, you know, of course, there are a certain amount of those things and those fundamentals will still stay, but it's a very different orientation. The other aspect I think that is going to be critical for people coming into the workforce is really figuring out the haves and the have-nots, because I feel like one of the challenges with technology is we've got to make the learning to become producers in this new economy as widely distributed as being consumers in this new economy is. Because I think, going back to my four forces of connected change, the societal pressures on all of us are to ensure that the power doesn't sit with a small group of people who are producing and creating wealth for themselves and the people in their organizations, while the rest of the world simply becomes a medium to be consumers, if you will, of whatever is being produced. So we've got to start to kind of shift the dynamic of basically creating a whole generation of people who are comfortable producing. And I think that goes back all the way into schools, into grassroots level engagement with communities, particularly of communities that are and have been hindered from technology and being far more diverse and inclusive in the way that we bring people into the kind of landscape. Because if we don't do that, the one risk that we have is you're potentially going to create millions, if not hundreds of millions of people who are mere consumers in the digital economy. And the producers are where all of the value sits, which will concentrate wealth and power in the hands of so few people. That, you know, I feel like the societal pressures that we're under now continue to get, you know, even greater.
Nigel Vaz, thanks for sharing your OMI with Bokomi today.
Thank you, Richard. It was great to be on.
Nigel Vaz's book, Digital Business Transformation, How Established Companies Sustain Competitive Advantage from Now to Next, is available to buy now in the Bokomi shop. Just follow the link in the description of the podcast. And if you'd like to be the first to hear and meet the brightest minds behind the smartest new nonfiction, sign up to our monthly most wanted email at bokomi.com. I'm Rich Kilgareth. Thank you for listening. And remember, change can happen with you rather than to you. Bye for now.